Okay, so welcome, Sondra, to Psycho and to this interview. And we're going to talk today about your experiences over the years, but with particular reference to the role or the impact of stigma in your life, in particular with stigma around having a mental health diagnosis. And I should probably just start off by saying that you've been teaching in the program here at Örebro University, the Psycholog program. How long is it now? Many years.
Yes.
But I guess it's maybe nearly 10, something like that. Yes. Yeah. So you teach in our program, and you do some guest lecturing in the psychopathology course, and you've been doing that, coming in and talking to our students about your own experiences and your own story. So I guess we can start off with something you just pointed out to me before we started recording, was just recently it was Bipolar Day.
Yes, in Sweden. That's right.
Yeah. And so I actually didn't realize that. What's Bipolar Day about? So what's the idea there?
It's for giving more information about living with bipolar disorder, but it also a way to spread disinformation, I think. So
yeah, and that's how it came up, because you were not particularly happy with something that came up the other day. So maybe you can start by telling us about that.
Well, it was a girl who wrote on Instagram that all that had bipolar 1 have manic episode and depression, and they have a normal period for a long time. And it's very connected to situations.
Mm.
But I have a cycle. I have manic and I have depressions. And it just, it's like a circus.
And it just goes around and around.
And it doesn't have everything to do with what comes around. I don't have spring depressions like that, or autumn depressions. It's nothing like that for me. So I said, I don't have that description about my bipolar 1. So you should write that this is one perspective of bipolar 1.
And I guess this brings us into your role within the program, is that you've been speaking publicly about your experiences with bipolar, or your experiences in general. And I asked you early on about why you do this. So you're a professional public speaker and you speak about your experiences. Why do you do this?
I want to open knowledge that to have a psychiatric an illness, it doesn't mean I'm always sick.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's not always trauma. And you can be happy.
Yeah. So we've already discussed how we're going to sort of do this. And you and I sort of thought that maybe the way to do it is to kind of just go through a timeline of your experiences. And we'll be touching upon the mental health problems that have occurred and not occurred. And we'll do it kind of chronologically through your life. And so I should warn everybody, this is quite a dramatic story. You've led a very, very interesting life and continue to do so. And as is fitting with your story, it starts off, at least this part of your story starts off really dramatically. And you're in Bosnia.
Yeah.
So take us from there.
My father is from Bosnia. So when he met my mother, they divorced and he moved back to Bosnia. So other divorced children, they go between two cities. I went between two countries.
Mm.
And December 1992 was the starting point of the war in Bosnia. So, and I was at the airport because my father knew that he needed to get me out of the country.
And you're 12.
Were,
You're 12 at this stage, yeah. So you're 12 years old and your dad's got you at the airport.
They are closing down the borders.
Mm.
So.
I think you mentioned earlier that there's a lot of military there.
Yes, it was a lot of military and everybody was, you could feel the tension. And they have big guns. And I have never seen the military act like that. The police in Sweden is kindergarten. If you meet the military in Bosnia. So they didn't treat me as a child. It was just...
And I think... So your father is basically handing you over to send you to Sweden. And I think you've mentioned previously to me that did you have something written on you? So
you have a tag on your chest with your name, your birth, and where you're going and who is going to pick you up. And then they give you to the airline and they will watch so you get home safely.
Okay. So your father doesn't go with you on the airplane?
No, he wasn't allowed to because he had a Swedish passport.
Okay. So he's handing you over. What do you understand is happening at that point in time? I know it's hard to remember now, it's a long time ago, but what do you remember thinking at the time?
I was very scared because I didn't know what was going to happen and if I was going home because we were trapped at the airport for a long time before we can get on the plane. And the security at this time, and no one wanted to talk about it.
Hmm.
I think everybody was just afraid to mention it's war now.
Hmm. So at 12 years old, I'm guessing you have no idea what's happening.
No.
And do you know when you're going to see your father next at that point?
No.
Okay. So you managed to get out of Bosnia in time and you're sent on the plane without any parents and you arrive in Sweden. And then I guess we're going to link up here to I guess your first experience of mood problems.
Yeah.
So can you tell us a bit about that? So you're 12?
When I got home, I just felt drained. And then I get told about war and we started to watch on the news. The city that my grandmother and most of my family lived, they lived in Vitis. In Bosnia, and they were blowing up the town. You can see that on TV. And I said, why am I here in Sweden? Why am I safe? Why not my grandpa, grandmother, and my cousins? Do we know? Are they alive? And no one could tell them. We didn't have contact with my father because they couldn't phone out. And I started to, in my privilege, in some way, it was very hard for me to understand that it has nothing to do with me.
So it sounds like you're describing something similar to what people often refer to as survivor guilt, perhaps.
Yes.
But it's not just that, though, is it? Because you go into... I think you describe a very deep depression.
Yeah.
For many months. And
I started to be hard on myself.
So a lot of guilt. Probably something that's worth mentioning here because this is going to connect with your diagnosis. Both of your parents have bipolar diagnosis.
Yes.
And so at this time when, so people start to notice that you're not doing okay?
Yes, in school. I didn't go out of bed. You couldn't. I had drapes on the windows, and I was just in bed.
You with you, so you're in Sweden, your father is still in Bosnia?
Yes.
Yeah, but you're with your mum?
Yeah.
Yeah. In, you've told me previously your mum, professionally, she's a, or was?
Yes, a mental nurse.
Mental health nurse, okay. So she, yes. So she starts to notice that something's not okay. And she's trying to get some help.
But I was so young.
Mm.
And at that time, I don't think science could put the depression on a child.
Mm.
At that magnitude, there was like, oh, but she's traumatized. A lot of things happened. Let her be.
Yeah.
But my mom didn't think that's just going to go away.
No. So she thought it was something more than just the effects of being traumatized.
Yes.
And you have two parents with bipolar diagnoses, which means that you're possibly quite vulnerable to developing a mood disorder, would have been called at the time, or now we call them bipolar illness. So your mum has some sense that this is not just trauma, and so you end up having a very deep depressive episode at 12 years of age. And then I think you start having some very difficult thoughts about yourself.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a bit about that? At 12 years of age, which is very, very young.
Death became an obsession. Instead of being thankful to be alive, I thought maybe I should be dead too.
Okay. So you start experiencing what we call suicidal ideation. You start to think about taking your own life. So it sounds like we have a very nasty combination of things here. You've been through a very traumatic experience. Which is understandably making you feel very guilty, but also you're carrying what in hindsight now is probably a vulnerability to developing mood episodes.
Yeah.
And at 12 years of age, you find yourself in a severe depressive episode. And that lasted for several months. But then you recovered.
Yeah.
And we jump forward now to when you're 15 and the lion emerges.
Yes.
Tell us about the lion or what happened when you were 15.
I started to get a manic episode and I was a raging maniac, a crazy person at school and at everybody. I was so angry and I made everything a fight. Because I was boxing at this point in my life and I was a trainer. And I remember just screaming at the attendant because they didn't listen to me.
Mm.
And I was like, is something wrong here? So,
so this is not just you being a generally angry person. This is real severe irritability.
Yes.
Very, very irritated.
If you said yes, I would say no.
Yeah. So
I was like a snake.
In hindsight, it seems like you had your first manic episode here. And one of the hallmarks of manic episodes for some people is real irritability, getting very easily angry with everybody. So you're at school, you're 15, you're getting highly irritable. Did you notice what else was going on then? There's sort of other things that are pretty typical of manic episodes. So sleep, I can probably ask you about your sleep during that time.
I didn't sleep, and I thought that everybody was so slow at everything.
Hmm.
And the teachers, I didn't think they had something good to say, so I wanted to teach them.
So you said everybody was really slow. Do you remember what was going on with your rate of thought, like the often when people are elevated or manic, they get what we call this sort of flight of ideas, this rapid rate of thinking. And do you remember that happening?
Yeah, I had a lot of that.
Hmm.
And I finished a lot of courses that I shouldn't really have finished, but I did. And in hindsight, I don't know how, because I don't have to math. I hate math, but I did one course at that time, so I was.
So you're kind of sped up. You're not sleeping. You're highly irritable. A lot of energy, and I guess we're going to touch upon stigma numerous times through your story, but this is maybe one of the first times that you start to experience some stigma. So the name we joked about before, the lion, was your classmates start to talk.
Yeah, they said that, you know, she's not okay, something is wrong, maybe she's cuckoo, I don't know, but some didn't want to, we had cliques.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have a clique. And I had a very hard time to find friends because they thought, no, she's not okay.
Mm. So just for anyone listening who's not that familiar with being manic, one of the hallmarks of a manic episode is that it's quite noticeable to other people. So we have something called hypomania, which is like a milder version, which other people might not necessarily spot unless they know the person very well. But by definition, becoming manic is very noticeable to other people. So it sounds like other people at school are noticing that, as you said, something's not okay here, and then they don't want to go near you.
No.
Hmm. So they're a bit scared, perhaps?
Yes, and they were talking a lot about it behind my back, and my sister, she heard about it, so. And I wouldn't listen to her because I didn't think there was something wrong because, well, you're stupid.
Hmm. Hmm. So is this is around the time that you receive a diagnosis, your first diagnosis?
Yeah.
And how did that come about? So how did you end up being diagnosed or being assessed?
It was on this episode because my mom, she like, okay, I can see a pattern here. And Sandra isn't like this.
Hmm.
And I read an interview in a magazine, and a classmate from this time called me and said, if we only knew what the problem was,
hmm.
we would have done something different.
Hmm.
And I think that was the big thing, because nobody knew about mental health. You knew about schizophrenia.
Hmm.
And there was and Cuckoo's Nest with Jack Nicholson.
Yeah. So your classmates don't know anything about this stuff. And when you start to behave in a different way, they have no idea what's going on, and they basically just withdraw. So one of the things we know about, and there are different things that contribute to the development of stigma, but lack of knowledge is one of them. So there's a good indication where there's lack of knowledge in, I guess, you know, 15 bunch of teenagers, and we get this sort of stigma response.
And teenagers are mean.
Yes, sometimes, yes. okay, so you receive a diagnosis, and then typically with a diagnosis of bipolar, people are prescribed medications, antidepressants, mood stabilizers. What happened with you with medication at that stage?
I got mood stabilizer and I got antidepressant, but I didn't think that I needed one. They didn't give me enough reason to take it.
Mm.
And I didn't feel that I was depressed at that time. So
when you were, I think you've already alluded to this, but when you were elevated, you were saying you didn't think that the problem was with you. You thought that the problem was with everybody else.
Yes.
So one of the hallmarks of definitely mania, but also hypomania to a lesser degree, is what we call a lack of insight. So often people that are elevated have no idea that they're elevated. And I'm guessing if you don't believe that you're unwell, why would you take a medication?
Yes.
And they haven't explained to you why. So you don't see any reason why. You don't recognize that you're struggling with something and no one's given you a good explanation. So understandably, you don't take any medication.
They told me that my feelings were stronger and not quite right. And I was like, my feelings is not wrong. Maybe your feelings is wrong.
It doesn't sound like the greatest explanation or something. Would I be right in guessing that when you've experienced depressive episodes that you're much more aware that something's not okay? So yeah. It's when you're more elevated that you're not sort of aware, but when you're depressed, that's pretty obvious to you. Yeah, okay. So you've been diagnosed at 15 and school, other kids at school are starting to avoid you because they notice something's wrong. You get a diagnosis, you don't take the medication because why should you? And then a few years later when you're in gymnasia, you have another episode.
Yeah.
So you're about 17 at this stage. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah. This is Hare Krishna, right?
I think it's just before. So when we talked about this before, I think you went into another depression.
Yes. Sorry.
It's okay. There's a lot of details over many years. It's okay for me. I've got the notes written down here. Yeah. We've already had a pre-discussion. I've taken notes and time frames and ages. So I'm cheating. I've got it all written down. You're just trying to remember.
No, that's right. I got a depression after. And this is when I start with amphetamine.
So you go into a depression and then you start using amphetamine to lift you up again. Okay. And so, I mean, we often talk about people self-medicating. So in hindsight, were you taking amphetamine to lift a depression or were you taking amphetamine because the typical reasons people take amphetamine?
I wanted to be myself. And this time it was a lot of rave parties.
Yeah.
It was the in thing to do. So, and I was a rave dancer, so I got in contact with a lot of these people. And I thought, okay, I could try it. And it worked. I could cope with school. I could cope with practice. Even though it wasn't kind of the best way to cope because you get a whole lot of problems with drugs.
Yeah. So at 17, so you're having trouble with depression again and you're self-medicating there. And then at 18, so it's probably fair for me to say at this stage you're having a lot of trouble with mood instability and maybe not such great success at working out how to manage it.
That's right.
But then at 18, you joined the Hare Krishnas.
Yes. I have known the Hare Krishna for quite some time. And you have Sunday parties where you go to their location and you meet people from there. And I was like, oh, you have it so, you are so calm. You look so happy. What's the secret? And they said, well, this is it. And you can live in Stockholm, Horsnesgården, and be a bhakti, en lärjunge. But you have to leave your name, identity, and will at the door. But I thought, they have something that I want, so I have to try it.
So you're looking at them and going, they have some stability, they have some calmness, they don't seem to be in chaos. And given the previous years you've described, it's pretty chaotic. You're going from depressive episodes to manic experiences to, so you go and live in Stockholm for a year.
Yeah.
And you learn something very important.
Yeah. I learned that if I have rituals and I have someone boundaries around me and know that I have to do it. Because in Hare Krishna, you have your duties. If you don't do your duties, someone else has to do them. And the time to do your duties is minimal.
Hmm. So amongst other things, you're living in Stockholm, and the way that you're living there is highly organized, very stable, sleep hours, what you're eating, what you're doing. And you find this...
You're not allowed to watch TV. You're not allowed to read anything that is not Hare Krishna. You go to bed at 22 in the night and you wake up 4.
Hmm.
I worked in the kitchen, so you don't have time for naps or breaks. Everything is very, very controlled in that environment.
And so there's probably some listeners who are thinking, oh, I don't really like the sound of that. That's very restrictive. But you actually find it very helpful.
Yes.
So you notice living with these really stable rituals and stable rhythms, I guess you might say.
Yeah.
And you find that your mood, what happens with your mood?
I start to control them. Because you're not allowed to talk in a loud voice. You're not allowed to scream at anyone.
Hmm.
And I could stop it.
So this is really interesting because... along with medication, one of the main components of managing bipolar illness is what we call controlling social rhythms, which is this stabilizing sleep patterns and eating and activity, these sorts of things. And so you seem to have bumped into this same kind of, obviously it's come in a different context, but you've, of your own accord, discovered that stabilizing how I spend my days actually is quite useful with my mood.
Yes.
So you've bumped into these rituals or these rhythms and you've discovered they have an effect. And then you've told me previously that there's something else you learn here. So you've discovered rituals, but also something else.
I discovered to know that I can do it. I don't need... Well, I needed medication, but I needed this more than anything.
So you've discovered that you could manage yourself.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty wonderful realization. So we probably don't need to go into too much of the details, but you decide to leave the Hare Krishnas.
You have to be married. Or they prefer you to marry or to get an andligt namn. And I wasn't ready to change my name, identity, and get married. I was too young.
Because you're 18, right, at this stage? Yes. Yeah. So they want you to formally change your, not just take another name, but they want you to actually formally change your identity. And okay. Okay. So you've stumbled upon the use of rituals and rhythm and helping you to manage your mood, but then it's time to move on because that's not what you want to do with your life. And then what happens next? You go back to, well, you go and start makeup school.
Yeah.
What happens around that time? You enter a national contest.
Yes. Makeup school and Fröken Sverige, tävling.
Which, you know, I'm just going to translate to English. It's kind of like, what is it in English? Like Miss Universe or something, or it's a beauty competition.
Miss Sweden.
Miss Sweden, okay.
Yes, Miss Sweden, yeah.
Hmm.
And I did all their makeup to my contestant friends also. But they discovered that I had an eating disorder, anorexia. And I knew this, but I didn't want to know about it. But you can't be a contestant and have an illness like that.
Hmm. How long do you think you'd been struggling with that in hindsight?
Since last year in gymnasium.
Okay.
Really, really bad.
Hmm. And it gets really bad and you end up in hospital.
Yes.
Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Well, they took also started to look at my bipolar and then what I needed to have for treatment for it.
Hmm.
Because they also thought that it's a link between those two.
So I'm guessing they're thinking, well, we're trying to help her manage the anorexia here, and the untreated bipolar is going to make that very difficult.
Yes.
Apart from, you know, might be worthwhile getting treated in its own right, it's going to play havoc with anorexia. Okay. Things get pretty bad while you're at that stage.
Yes, because I didn't want to listen, even though I was committed in. So my mom put the hard on hard and said, I won't help you and I won't be with you until you acknowledge it's your responsibility and it's your life. I can't save your life for you. You need to do that.
And your life had been a great risk while you're on that admission, I think.
Yes.
Hmm. And from talking previously, that was the first time you tried to take your own life.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're in hospital getting treated for anorexia, but also I guess the doctors are starting to talk more about or put more pressure on you to do something with the bipolar medication. So there's a suicide attempt while you're in treatment, and then mum comes along and says, right, that's it. You've got to take some responsibility here. Okay. But then you get out of hospital, so you start to recover.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you move.
Yeah.
So at that stage, where were you then? You're up in Stockholm or you're in?
Karlstad.
You're in Karlstad, yeah.
Hospital, Karlstad. Mm.
And you move to?
Malmö.
Malmö, which is down south for those who are not familiar with Swedish geography. So you go down to Malmö
to start over and to start a florist flower education.
Mm-hmm. And you meet someone down there?
Yes, because I work with makeup and I love drag shows.
Hmm.
So I did makeup behind the scenes at drag shows, and I met Daniel, whose stage name was Darling. So, and we bonded because he also had bipolar disorder. We could talk about things, and we could, you know, oh, you have also felt that way, you have also done that. And it started to, you know, put some dots together.
So you found that really helpful to be able to speak with someone.
Yeah.
Who also had similar experiences.
Because you didn't have internet, you didn't have Facebook, you didn't have föreningar or congregations or something like that. So you don't know if there are other people who has the same experiences you have.
Hmm.
Even though in the hospital there was a lot of strange people at that time, but I didn't think that I was one of them.
Hmm. And I guess if you're on a what we call an acute ward with people that are acutely unwell, there are going to be lots of different people with lots of different things going on. So it may be the case. I mean, I'm guessing in an acute ward, you're probably going to be bumping into a lot of people with psychotic illness or schizophrenia or these sorts of things, amongst other things. So I could totally understand how you might be looking around and thinking, well, I don't relate to these people.
No, and that was it. That was like, oh, I'm not like that.
Hmm.
We had one who peed all over the floor every day.
Yeah.
So when she didn't get her way, she did that. So I don't do that.
Yeah.
She's
crazy. So no one, including you, really knows anything about what's going on here.
No.
What is bipolar illness? Or so we've had your friends at school who have reacted in a certain way, who didn't know anything about it. You don't really know what's going on. Now you said previously that so Daniel is also experiencing stigma.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
He worked as a drag show artist, and it's like you're a man in women's clothes, and you dance and you mime. And he was straight. And a straight man in women's clothes will get people talking. But he loved his work.
Hmm.
But it started to tear on his soul that he wasn't a part of the gay community. He wasn't a part of the straight community. But he was like, I don't know, why do I need to be something? Can't I just be me? And at that time, it wasn't like that.
How did you relate to that? I mean, you were starting to have your own experiences of stigma, of being feeling different or being treated differently.
I think that's when we realized that we have each other. We can be something.
Hmm.
And we have experienced the same thing, but different ways.
Hmm.
Because I just wanted to be me.
Yeah, and I guess you're growing up and you're having these experiences and people are telling you that your feelings are too strong.
Yes.
Or they're wrong. Or, yeah. Okay. So what happens next? It's not a particularly happy part of the story.
No. Daniel, he started to feel, he started to withdraw a lot. And I had a lot on my mind. I had a lot to do, and I didn't have time to connect with him as much as I used to. And then he went through a very hard time and he shot himself.
Hmm.
And he did it. I think he shot himself because he was a hunter with his dad, and he wanted to do it a male way. If you can. It was like his life. You know, he was gorgeous as a woman in clothes, and he wanted to be a man, so he was a hunter. So it's what.
Yeah. So I'm guessing the stigma he'd experienced that you guys had started to share, that's obviously played a role in him taking his own life.
I think when you don't belong, it tears apart you. You need to know that what you feel and who you are is okay. Not to get alive.
So at that time when Daniel takes his own life, you have a partner and you guys decide to do something.
Yes, because we didn't know a lot about who can we turn to if you have these thoughts. Can we call someone? Can we do anything? And we started to connect with other who has felt suicide thoughts, because I have been at a hospital, Daniel has been at a hospital. So we started to find these people and talk about, can we do something together? So we started a network with people who wanted to help other people with their thoughts.
And so this is probably a pretty obvious question, Will. Sorry. There's an obvious answer to this question, is that, I mean, from your own experiences and then starting to sort of be involved in supporting other people, do you think that this is helpful when people are feeling isolated or stigmatized, to be able to have contact or to know that, yeah. Do you think it would have, what sort of a difference might it have made in your own life when you were younger?
I think it would have made a lot of difference if someone would just say, it's nothing wrong with your feelings, but they can put you in a situation that is not good for you, and you need to understand why.
So if it had been something that people knew more about, that people spoke about more openly, it might have helped you to manage those years in a different way. Yeah. Okay, so moving on a bit, you leave Malmo, understandably, and you go off to a place in Sweden called Nyköping, which I probably just said very wrong.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm getting better. It's only taken 10 years. Start over again, and you take another direction in your career. Do you want to tell us about that?
I started as croupier. My father has had restaurants and hotels all my life, so I have been behind the scenes. So, and croupier and roulette tables, it's you don't need to think about anything.
So croupier is you're dealing cards, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you start working as a croupier. I think from previous conversations, you travel a bit with that as well.
Yeah. You go to numerous cities to be at their card tables or roulette tables. So. And I had a player, a VIP player, and it's quite common to players, they go with their croupier because they are winning. So I didn't think very much of it. But he had another idea of what I was to him. So today we call it a stalker. At that time, they were called an admirer. So. And In Nyköping is a very small town. It doesn't happen anything. So I don't know if I didn't lock my door because I don't even think I thought about it. But he was in my apartment one night when I came home.
And you recognized him from when you were working?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Not at first because he took stroke behind. But I knew his voice. And then I see his side. So. Then I knew who he was. But he didn't know that I am a boxer. I have boxed a long time, so he didn't have a victim. So he got quite angry. And then I met the police, and they said, why would he even think he could be in your apartment? You have to said something. You must have done something. You must have been encouraging to him. But it's my job. It's my job to be nice. It's my job to ask, what are you doing today? Or so.
And there's a court case. He goes to trial. And then you get to be on the end of some pretty dramatic stigma, actually. Can you tell us a bit about that?
His lawyer, he had a very firmed opinion on what a bipolar person is like, and he said we are very fiery and we have addiction, we are very passionate about everything and we want to go to bed with everybody. And I was like, no, that's not true. I've been in Hare Krishna for 1 year, God's sakes. But he made me feel like I couldn't determine who I was as a person when he was just talking to me at that rate of things.
So if I'm understanding this, the thrust of his point here is that this is your fault because you have bipolar illness.
Yes.
But you have somehow contributed to this.
Yes, I must have been so luring because we are so passionate about everything and we drink, we have sex, we have drugs. Everybody knows that about a bipolar person.
Pretty sure those things are typical of most people at varying stages. it's not unique to bipolar illness. Just for anyone listening who's not so familiar with bipolar diagnoses, you get a lot of disinhibition. Some people get disinhibited. Some people are drawn towards what they call pleasurable activity with negative consequences. So I can see what he's seized upon there is looking at some criteria and some words and then extrapolating from that. It's obviously completely unreasonable to be presuming any one person does anything based on criteria in the DSM. But that's what he's seized upon. He thinks he's seen an argument in the criteria. How did the court respond to that? Because that was the defense of the stalker, right? This is the defense attorney who is trying to defend his client who's been charged with, what was he charged with? Breaking and entering, I don't know, assault.
Assault.
Okay. How did the court respond?
They said it wasn't right what he did, but they didn't put all the blame on him because it must be some truth in what the defense are saying. So
based on the fact that you had a bipolar diagnosis, some of the blame was attributed to you.
Yeah, because I was violent. I fought with a lot of violence, but I said I was scared and I had to defend myself. Isn't that okay? And they said, no, not that kind of violence. It's not normal. But I think that anyone in that position would do the same thing.
Do you think, I mean, it's probably not something that ever can be known now, but do you think that they would have used that reasoning if you didn't have a bipolar diagnosis? If you didn't have a bipolar diagnosis and you fought back to protect yourself when being attacked by a person in your own home, do you think they would have drawn the same conclusion?
No. I think they would have said, oh, good for you.
Just for the record, do you think having a bipolar diagnosis had anything to do with this guy attacking you?
No.
No, nothing to do with it whatsoever. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting that you have this crime being committed, and because you have a previous diagnosis that you're attributed as part of the cause.
I lost.
Yeah.
I lost the court.
So understandably, you move again. Yes. And then by some really unfortunate turn of luck or chance or something, you start to have another experience there. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, I moved to a new city and I had a secret phone number and a secret address. And the phone started to ring. And it was someone on the other line, but you couldn't hear. And I started to think like, oh my God, I'm found.
So you're worried about the stalker still?
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
So that was my first reaction. And this kept going. And I talked about it at my new work. I said, oh, the phone, blah, blah, blah. And they say, do this thing and trace the call. And I said, okay. So I did that. And for a whole 2 weeks, the phone didn't ring at all while I was tracing it. So after the 2 weeks, the phone started again. So I thought, this is someone I know, and this is someone on my job. This someone in my office is doing this. So I started to get so paranoid. Now I can see the humor in it, but I was like lurking behind the corners to just listen what people are saying, because I know he's here. And my co-workers and my boss thought that I don't think Sandra is okay anymore. So
I think on one hand, I can totally understand you becoming very, very concerned about what was behind these phone calls. But I think when we've talked about this before, that wasn't all that was going on.
No. Was also my feelings and my suicide. This is my suicide attempt.
So you're becoming very paranoid.
Yes.
Well, I didn't even know it was fair enough to say paranoid, because you've the horrific experience with a stalker has attacked you, and then you're getting all of these strange calls. So you are feeling very, very scared for good reason, but This is happening whilst you're becoming very depressed?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we found out who this boy was, the phone call. It was a young boy. He was about 15 years old, and he had a diagnosis of some kind. So he had put in the phone number by random, and he liked my voice. So he remembered it. So they had nothing to do with me or anything else. So, and these 2 weeks that it was quiet, I said that in court because we had to go to court again. And I said, what about these 2 weeks? And his mother said, I'm so sorry, but he was on vacation that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that I just, oh my God. I felt like the worst person ever because I had destroyed a young man's life because he is now a sex offender because of the phone calls. Was sexual. And I thought, I am destroying people's lives here. Look at Daniel. I couldn't save his life. Look at everything that's happened. The stalker, I was like, oh, I destroyed his life too. Maybe. I need to leave.
And just for anyone listening who's not too familiar with a major depressive episode, one of the hallmarks of becoming severely depressed is becoming extremely guilty.
Yeah.
And those feelings and thoughts of guilt can become distorted and they can become psychotic eventually. So people sometimes will start to feel intense guilt around things that are not their responsibility. So you're what sounds like in a severe depressive episode, feeling extremely guilty, and you decide, well, that's it.
Yes, because if someone like me continue living, I will destroy more lives. And that's not fair. So.
Is this where we need to mention your cat?
Yeah. I am the crazy cat lady. I had a cat, she called Selma. At the night that I had planned, I knew I wouldn't survive because I had read about it. So I used all the methods I could find. Overdose, alcohol, a knife, and water. And I was calm. I know the feeling because it was like the best feeling in the world.
Because you were going to escape.
Sorry?
Because you were going to escape.
Yeah. And I was happy. But Selma, she started to notice that I was slipping away. And well, she was starting to scream. Not Yama, she sounded like an injured animal. And my, the time, boyfriend, Charlie, we had broken up for a while, but he wanted to return the key because we didn't live in the same city. So he was like, oh, I'm going through the city, so I'm going to leave the key. I know Sandra isn't home, so there wouldn't be any problems. But he heard Selma when he opened the door. And he thought that she was hurt and injured. So he said, oh, you have to save Selma. Otherwise, Sandra is going to hunt me down and kill me. And when he opened the door, he found me. And he could control the bleeding and he could phone. And I was brought in by ambulance.
So saved by Selma.
Yes. That's so why I have a cat and a heartbeat. On my arm.
So it's when you're in hospital following the suicide attempt, and that's when, so up until this point, you're still not really using any medication.
No. But now I realize that I have tried everything else. It's time to accept lithium.
So you start using lithium,
yeah,
and you recover, yes. And you decide, well, I'm going to go back to work.
Yeah.
then something happens.
Yes, I started to get a stomach ache.
Well, let me just back up a bit. So I'm cheating again. I've got the timeline here. It's not fair, I know. But you're trying to go back to work, and that's again when stigma starts to rear its head.
Yeah, because it was like, oh, are you ready for this? You know, this is quite stressful job.
So you're applying for jobs, and so how do they know that you have a diagnosis?
It's the same job. I am at the same job.
Oh, you're returning. Yeah. Okay, so that was the previous work where they were noticing that you were, because something was wrong in them. So you try to go back.
Yeah.
And so what do they end up doing?
They said I should change a part. Where do you call it? Change floor. And like sorting letters and things like that.
Okay. So they want to move you out of whatever role you're in, and they want to put you in a less demanding role, or a less, what they think is a less stressful role.
I was a team leader, so.
Do you remember how it made you feel at the time?
Very stupid.
So it made you feel stupid?
Yeah, because I was a team leader. I had a team. I was a good salesman. I was good at my job. So why would you put someone in the corner like?
So now you're feeling stupid. And what happens with that employer in the end? We obviously don't need to name them, but what happens with that employer in the end?
They said they didn't have work for me. So.
So when you come back from hospital, are you given the opportunity to come back into role and to demonstrate that you can still fulfill your role, or do they just downgrade you?
They downgraded me because I was gone a long while, and they knew it was because suicide attempt. And a suicide attempt can't be a leader.
Okay, so it wasn't that you returned to work and weren't able to fulfill the role. No, okay. So basically you lose your job because you've had a psychiatric hospital admission. And if you'd broken your leg and had a hospital admission, do you think you would have lost your job?
No.
No, of course not.
But it was like, oh, maybe we can't say that. I think we will be suicidal again. But I think it doesn't work like that. I don't get suicidal because you tell me you have another opinion.
So they think you're now suddenly extremely fragile and delicate. Yeah. And if they, yeah, okay. And I guess perhaps if they understood something more about depressive episodes or bipolar illness, then they may draw another conclusion. Okay. So there we go again. So there's stigma, and now you've lost your job. We're going to leap forward a bit here. You end up back in hospital again, but under very different circumstances. Can you tell us about that? Because this is, again, another one of these quite dramatic examples of stigma impacting your life.
With my stomach aches, a doctor said, but you little girl, you are so silly. You have manic depression. Do you want to feel good in your head or in your stomach?
So just to back up here, you start to get a lot of pain.
Yes, I had a lot of pain in my stomach, and I was feeling nausea a lot.
Probably something that's worth pointing out here for people is at this stage you're taking lithium, and lithium can have some pretty major side effects if it's used in the wrong way. So for a person who's taking lithium, acute pain is probably worth paying attention to. But they don't.
No.
So what's he saying? He's saying because you have a bipolar diagnosis, you're just what? So what he thinks that you're just looking for attention?
Yes.
Pretty sure that's not one of the criteria for bipolar disorder, seeking attention. But anyway, it's got nothing to do with bipolar disorder. So, okay, so you're trying to get some help for a lot of pain. and you're mm-hmm. taking a medication which is pretty serious medication. So you've been sent away a few times, I guess. You're trying to get some help.
Yeah.
What happens?
Every time it was something stupid said, like, because at that point I started to throw up and I had extreme diarrhea that I couldn't control in public.
Mm.
And he said, well, maybe you're doing it because you want the attention. And I said, I don't need that attention. I'm a girl. I would never do that in public. So I couldn't understand why they didn't listen to me.
And just to be clear, why do you think they weren't listening to you?
He said it was the first time we went to the doctors. One doctor put in the journal that I had stomach ache, but I had had anorexia and I had an mental illness. So I shouldn't be treated at the normal acute. You should just straight to seek acute.
Okay. So because you had a history of mental health problems,
yeah,
that would mean that anything that was now happening should be considered a mental health problem.
Yes.
So that's quite amazing. So according to that logic, if you've had a mental health problem, you somehow become immune to other health problems. That's quite amazing.
Yeah.
It suddenly become interesting. Okay. And then what happens next? So they keep bouncing you away and saying, no, it's just a psychiatric problem. You've had psychiatric problems in the past, and that means anything now is a psychiatric problem.
Even my mom tried to get help from me, and they said, oh, she's that kind of mom.
Mm. Okay.
But then a friend came to my house, and when I opened the door, I felt an explosion of pain. And it went to the core of me. And I felt, I'm dying. And it was, then they took my stomach aches. Because when I came in at the hospital, they noticed that I needed to have a surgery. And tarmar, what's that called?
Oh, you put me on the spot here. Tarmar is
intestines.
Is it appendices?
Maybe.
Your appendix. Maybe your appendix exploded.
No, it's tarmar.
Was it gallbladder?
It was the gallbladder had broke with a lot of stones, and the stone had rubbed against the intestines and destroyed all my insides.
Okay.
So I was leaking from the stomach and from the intestines.
Okay. Well, whatever exactly it wasn't good.
No.
No. So you're having a major medical crisis.
Yeah. An 8-hour surgery to save my life. I had a good surgeon who had never seen such a mess when he opened me, because he didn't find what he should find and he didn't know how to stop it from bleeding.
Mm. And there was plenty of warning before this, before something exploded. There was plenty of warning.
Yes. Hey, they looked at it the second time I went to the doctors and just given me an MRI. They have seen it.
Hmm. But they weren't listening to you because of your diagnosis.
No. Hmm. So I woke up and I had 6 tubes coming out of my stomach, and I was uppkopplad till maskiner.
Connected to machines?
Yeah.
For the non-Swedes listening?
and I didn't have any feelings. I have lost.
You couldn't feel anything.
No.
Mm.
Because they had to destroy the nerves to get at all the things. And my surgeon put in to the Lex Maria. It is when you report the hospital.
So there was a complaint put in about the way that you were, yeah. Okay. Do you know if anything ever came of that?
Yes, I went on förlikning.
You're really testing my very limited Swedish here. Förlikning.
Oh, what do you call it? I said, okay, I will drop the charges if the first doctor who wrote that I shouldn't be taken care of because I have a mental illness, I want that person to lose his job and his license. Then I will back down from this court.
Mm.
And I won that one.
Mm.
But in hindsight, I couldn't got millions of kronor.
Mm.
But I didn't have the strength to fight.
No, because you then, excuse me with my timeline and cheating, you then moved back to, well, you moved to Örebro,
mm-hmm.
which is where we are. And because you need to be looked after, your mum's going to help you through what's going to be a very long physical rehab. How long was the physical rehab?
5 years. And then 2 years to try to get back to the job.
Yeah.
Of some kind.
And within that period, you connect with another group?
Yeah. Jehovah's Witness knocked on my door. And at that time, I knew my mother in Örebro, but I didn't know of very much people, and they were very nice, and we started to talk, and I got a lot of help. If I didn't got that help, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. So I'm so helped. I'm so grateful for that. So
here comes in another group, and they're providing support and care and contact and help.
And also routine.
Routines and structure and yeah.
Yeah.
Are you taking lithium again at this stage? Because I'm imagining that when you had the crisis, it would have been hard to be taking the medication. So that's all kind of settled down again, and you're back to. And I guess by this stage, you sound like you're fairly convinced that you need to take.
Yes, and the doctors could prove to me that lithium has nothing to do my stomach. So it was that it had nothing to do with it. So it was just a bad coincidence.
Just a coincidence, yeah. Okay.
So, but I changed it from another, mine is called Litarex. Instead of lithium, it's called Litarex. It's a little bit different, but okay. It's the same.
Yeah. So you go through a very long rehab. You get some support by connecting with Jehovah's Witness. You eventually leave Jehovah's Witness, I think.
Mm.
And you're once again trying to return to work.
Yeah.
And then stigma pops up again.
Because I had been gone for so much long time, they thought that I don't think the workplace needs someone like you. You should be happy.
How old are you at this stage?
This is 2011, 12.
Mm.
I'm 43 now.
Okay. So you're in your early 30s and you're being told that you don't need to go back to work. in your early 30s. Okay.
Because so, I will fail.
Okay. And they're proposing, what are they proposing instead?
To find a hobby.
And they're going to put you on a health disability benefit insurance or something.
Yeah.
So they're going to kind of check you out of working society at that point in your early 30s, when you've got typically most people here in Sweden work till they're what, early 60s or mid 60s?
Mm.
So 30 years early, they've decided that you're not going to, you know.
And that was when I became like, you don't know me.
Mm.
Give me some credit.
Mm.
And then when I put together this show, Life Behind the Glitterblicken, because I wanted to tell people what it was like to have an illness, but still, I'm still a person and I still have hopes and dreams and I can do a lot of things.
Mm.
But I need you to give me that chance.
So, you start in a Bakom Glitterblicken.
Yeah.
And then you also start to do public speaking.
Yeah.
So this is your response to being told that you don't have anything to offer. So you just decide to do something anyway.
Yeah.
So maybe you can tell us just briefly about the Bakom Glitterblicken.
It was a show from the beginning, and now it is a social cooperation. Today, I educate others who want to share their stories and do it the right way, and to talk about how you can change a bad thing to a good thing. And that's the core that I want to people to know. You can't judge someone what they have in their medical journals.
Hmm. And you start doing public speaking. This is how we bumped into you.
Yeah.
And you start speaking for an organization called Hjärnkoll. And you start doing guest lectures. So that was about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So for 10 years you've been public speaking. You speak about every 6 months at the university, at least with us, maybe more. What other sorts of places have you been, what sort of other contexts do you do public speak?
I have big shows with you. They Who Live in Örebro. I had a show with Smash Into Pieces. It's now they are world famous. I was like, they've been on my show. But it's a very funny show. I talk with a lot of stand-up community also. So sometimes people, they laugh, but they don't even know why they want to laugh. But I think it's important to not just look at the negatives.
Mm. So you've been doing performances, you do lecturing.
Yeah.
I think you do some corporate speaking as well.
Yes. Now I'm back on my beauty job, so to speak. So.
Oh, and you started doing makeup therapy. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Makeup has always been in my life. I knew when I was 9 years old, when I saw Off the Dark, which is a drag show here in Sweden, that's my destiny. So makeup has always been in my life. And when I was in rehab, I used to have makeup as a way to make other people feel good. So I make women who have cancer, and we have also burn victims, all kind of diseases.
Mm.
So I started makeup rehab in 2014.
And you do that all over Sweden, don't you? Because whenever I'm in contact with you, you're always off somewhere or coming back from somewhere. Or...
Yeah. Hmm. So it grew a lot. And with the pandemic, we had to go online.
So for the person who was going to be checked out in their early 30s from working, you've now gone on in recent years and you're quite successful, actually. You're very busy. You're always doing something. And you're traveling despite the fact that you have bipolar illness. How is that possible? How on earth could you possibly be managing this thing and traveling? And
I have a lot of discipline and rituals. And I don't give myself. If I feel depressed, I go up. I get out of bed. And I go to work. Because I know that's the only way that I can win.
So you've worked out how to manage your illness fine.
Yes.
You're still taking medication, obviously.
Yes.
You're using a lot of discipline. You're using the routines. My understanding is that you're pretty militaristic about when you go to bed.
Very.
And that's, I think, you know, for a lot of people that are managing bipolar, they find that to be a huge issue, is to be really careful with their sleep. So just when everybody's about to check you out, you then go off and start your own career. You kind of almost start your own industry almost. Something else sort of big happens as well that you're not supposed to be able to do with a mental health problem. You meet someone.
Yes.
Very briefly, tell us about that.
I meet Johan when I have a lecture on his workplace. So, and I saw him and I was like, I want to get to know that man. So what I didn't know that he has Asperger's. So I started to talk to him, but when he was finished with his conversation, he just went off. So, but now we are married. So I won.
And how long have you guys been together now?
Since 2012. Married in 2014.
So nearly 10 years.
Yeah.
And just to, this would be the last time we touch upon the stigma thing, I guess, but how have people reacted to you in terms of having a partner, or let alone when they hear that you both have a diagnosis?
At first, they thought very like, oh, it must be hard for him to have someone like you, because they have heard that bipolar is an anhörig sjukdom. And I say, it's not like that. It's only like that if he wanted to be. He has strict rules about me. So, and I think that's good. Now during the pandemic, when we are working both at home.
Yeah.
Sometimes he wants to throw shoes at me.
Yes, well, I think I've been working at home for a year as well, and yeah. Okay, so again, here's something that's supposed to be something you're not supposed to be able to do. And it, just out of interest, how does it actually affect you guys? Like, how much does a bipolar diagnosis or an Asperger's diagnosis actually affect you guys in the relationship?
I think that one of the things that I can't have children after my surgery. So if that was something, if he had wanted a child, then we will have a problem.
But is that because of the surgery or because of the bipolar?
Because of the surgery.
Yeah.
And I was being so scared of meeting someone and telling them that, I'm sorry, I can't have children. And he said, I don't want children. And I wouldn't want to give birth to a child because my mom and dad has bipolar and I have it. I wouldn't risk it. I'm sorry, but I wouldn't. But I have cats.
So. And you guys are happy. You're in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
So it's all gone very well after some really difficult experiences, despite some stigma. So just to finish up then, because this is, I've taken up a lot of your time here. So how does, if you were to summarize for someone, how does managing bipolar impact your life today?
Not as much because of the discipline. And I live the life that I always dreamed of. I have my dream job and I fight for it every day.
So. And you're pushing 10 years in a happy marriage.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have a good end to the story, at least at this point.
No one can tell you what to do or what's right, but you have to prove it. So.
Well, it's quite the story, and it's really nice to hear that despite being told you couldn't do things at varying stages, things have turned out well. I want to thank you for your time. It's quite a long time today, and I will see you in the future, as always.
Yeah.
Next time.
Yes.
Thanks very much, Sandra.
Hey.
Thanks.